The Guardian.
Hi, Hannah Devlin here. Before we get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
So here I want to just show you in the next few minutes how, in fact, some of the most remarkable developments in cosmology, and then tell you how they completely changed our picture of the universe so that we understand that the universe we live in is the worst of all possible universes to live in.
In 1933, Swiss astronomer Fritz Zwicky published a paper inferring the existence of what he called dunkle materia, or dark matter.
Again, amazing to think about.
It was decades before his theory was taken seriously by the scientific community. But today, the idea that the universe is filled with vast quantities of mysterious stuff that we can't see and have never detected directly is considered mainstream science. So what are researchers doing to probe the enigmatic nature of dark matter?
It's where nothing is shining. About 50 times as much mass in this system, and in all systems we can measure, comes from stuff that doesn't shine. And physicists, with their linguistic perspicacity, have called it dark matter.
I'm Hannah Devlin, and this is Science Weekly.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about that. I mean, again, you get a range of views on that, and they sort of would take a middle line.
To help guide me through what we do know about dark matter, I sat down with Dr. Andrew Ponson, an astrophysicist at University College London.
It's made and that have been successfully confirmed.
Yeah.
And so clearly it's a very good working theory, unlike...
I started by asking him, what is dark matter?
Well, the honest answer is we don't really know what dark matter is. The hypothesis that we're working with is that it's some kind of extra particle, so that the stuff that's around us, the familiar stuff that we can see and touch and interact with, is fundamentally made out of different particles. And the idea is there's just an extra type that is just very shy and doesn't interact with us in the same way that the normal regular particles that the world around us is made up of does. So it's just some extra particle that we have to discover.
And how do we know that it's actually there? Could you just tell me a bit about that?
We think it's there because when we look out into space, we need some extra stuff in, for example, galaxies to make sense of the way they're behaving. So one of the first pieces of evidence actually was from looking at the way that galaxies spin. And they're supposed to be just big collections of gas and stars, but they're actually spinning very quickly. And if you try and work out why would they be spinning so quickly, you need a very large force of gravity to be making them do that. And so you need something generating extra gravity beyond what you'd expect to be there.
So basically, astronomers looked up at the sky and saw roughly how many stars there were in the galaxy and worked out how much it would all weigh. And then there was a mismatch between how it was behaving and what they were able to add up.
Exactly. And now that's been replicated in all sorts of different situations. So it's not just, say, one galaxy. It's pretty much every galaxy you look at, you can reproduce this result. And then even bigger structures like clusters of galaxies where lots of galaxies have come together, you just keep getting back to the same result that you need about five times more stuff than you can actually see directly.
So we've got this idea that all this dark matter is out there. Do we know how it's distributed? Is it all clumped together at the centre, or is it just spread out evenly?
We know pretty well how it's distributed, and you can get at that from two different directions. One is to look at the observations, and if you measure in detail the way that galaxies are spinning, for example, you can then kind of work backwards through the equations of gravity to work out, well, where must the stuff be to make them spin in that particular way. And that gives you one pretty good handle. And it says that actually the dark matter is kind of spread out on really quite vast scales. So if you look at an individual galaxy, it would be surrounded by what we call a dark matter halo, which is many, many times larger than the galaxy itself. And the dark matter would be spread throughout that. And actually, now we can get at that whole problem from another route, which is on the assumption that dark matter exists and is a real thing, we can run computer programs to figure out how would the universe evolve on the basis of that assumption. And that actually makes predictions for the way that dark matter should be distributed around galaxies. And that kind of agrees that the dark matter would be spread out in this really massive halo around each individual galaxy.
So it appears that we know something about where dark matter is, and we'll come back to how scientists are mapping its distribution across the universe later. Before then, I wanted to know how dark energy, which is often mentioned alongside dark matter, ties in. Something I put to Andrew.
Dark energy is really quite a separate phenomenon that was discovered more recently when people started to realise from a number of different measurements that the expansion of the universe, which we've known about for a long time, is not quite doing what we'd expect. We'd sort of expect that the expansion would be coasting along and slowly slowing down, if anything, because gravity would be trying to pull the whole universe back together and kind of holding up the expansion. But actually, when people started measuring this, they realized the expansion of the universe is speeding up. So things are not only flying apart, but they're flying apart faster and faster. And that really is such a strange phenomenon that we don't have a clue what's going on, and we've just given it a name, which is dark energy. So it's really quite a separate thing from the dark matter, which is holding, say, individual galaxies together and which we hope we can explain quite soon.
So do we know how much of our universe is still in the dark then?
Yes, our current measurements suggest that actually what we can see is just 5% of what's in the universe. And then you have about 25% is made out of dark matter. And then the remaining 70% is made out of dark energy, whatever that turns out to be.
So astronomical observations can tell us how much dark matter there is and where it's hidden. But can they tell us what it is?
Until we actually get it in a lab, the only thing we can do is look at the universe. So there are a number of different measurements you can make about things out there in space that help you understand what dark matter could be. So one thing you can do is go back to galaxies, back to the basics, really, where this all started, and try and understand the way that they're moving internally in more and more detail. Because although we have a good handle on the way the dark matter is distributed through galaxies and around galaxies, actually, when you look at it in detail, the particular type of particle that it's made out of can change those predictions slightly. So if you can understand the way that it's distributed in reality, and compare that to predictions based on different types of particle, that gives you one handle on what's going on. You can also go up to much larger scales because we can actually measure the way that matter is spread through the universe on really vast scales in something that we call the cosmic web. And again, that responds to the particular type of particle that is making up the dark matter. So it's all about measuring the way that stuff seems to be spread through the universe and then trying to match that up with what the actual particle could be.
Yeah, that's much better. Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why cosmologists have been mapping our universe in increasing detail.
I mean, you're okay on my end, but I think when your voice goes up, it crackles a little bit. So
this is Dr. Peter Capak.
Yeah, that looks good. Okay, I'm Dr. Peter Capak. I'm an associate research scientist at the Infrared Processing Analysis Center, which is part of the California Institute of Technology.
Perfect. Well, thankfully, you'll be doing most of the talking, so...
Okay.
The levels on my side don't matter.
And one method he is using to hunt for dark matter is known as gravitational lensing.
To feature you on the show.
Producer Max spoke to Peter via Skype and started by asking him exactly what gravitational lensing is.
So gravitational lensing was first predicted by Einstein when he came up with general relativity. And the whole idea behind general relativity is that gravity isn't really a force. Gravity is the effect of matter on space and time. So you can think of it, if you put like a piece of plastic, like a garbage bag over top of a big trash bin, and then you put a ball in the center, the plastic would curve from the weight of the ball. And that's the same idea that any form of matter in the entire universe is causing the space around it to curve. But if space and time is really curved, then light should also be bent as it comes through that curved space and time. And so we can actually observe this in very, very massive clusters of galaxies where there are like hundreds of galaxies. We can actually see the light curved into arcs. And if you look around less massive galaxies, less massive objects, you can actually see slight distortions at the 1 or 2% level of the background galaxies with respect to the foreground.
And as explained by Peter, there are two kinds of gravitational lensing.
So strong gravitational lensing is what happens around clusters of galaxies, where the lens is so strong that it actually distorts the view of the background galaxy and turns it from a tiny, tiny speck into an arc around the galaxy cluster. And so it turns out that the strong gravitational lensing works very similarly to the bottom of a wine glass. So if you're ever, next time you're out for dinner, if you look at the bottom of your wine glass and look at a light source in the background, and you can see things lensed into arcs, that's very similar. It turns out to be very similar to the gravitational potential in a cluster of galaxies. So then the other type of gravitational lensing that we're trying to use to understand dark matter and dark energy is something called weak gravitational lensing. And so this is the same effect where the foreground galaxy lenses or magnifies the background, but at very, very small levels. We're talking 1 to 2% brighter and 1 to 2% stretched out. And what you can do is look at that in a statistical sense. So you look at a galaxy you can see in the foreground and one that you know is in the background, and you look for that galaxy to be slightly more elliptical or stretched out, tangential to the foreground galaxy. So you can think of drawing circles around foreground galaxies and looking at every galaxy that sits on that circle for millions of foreground galaxies, and then seeing how stretched out it is. And if you add them all up, you can measure the slight distortion in that galaxy, and then from that you can get a statistical sense of how massive those foreground galaxies are.
And by averaging out these different measurements, scientists are able to decipher how much gravitational lensing is occurring in different parts of the universe, and thus infer how much dark matter must be present. This is something the Euclid Consortium, which Peter is part of, is hoping to achieve when it sends a probe into space in 2019.
The idea is that you could go into space and make these very precise measurements of the shapes of galaxies to understand dark matter. And the experiment conceptually is that imagine you were trying to figure out what the humidity is in air. You can't see humidity, right? It's a property of the air. But if you can measure dewdrops on your lawn and you measure how quickly they're growing and you have a measure of temperature, you could infer what the humidity in the air is. And so, again, if you do this for any individual dewdrop, you'll have a large amount of error on the measurement because you won't know, is it because of the blade of grass it's growing on? Is it because of exactly where it sits in the lawn, this type of stuff? But if you can do it over many, many millions of them, you could get an inference of the humidity of the air. So Euclid is the same idea, that we'll make these very precise measurements of billions of galaxies and their dark matter. And then if we know the distance to the galaxy, we can look at the drops of dark matter growing over time, and that will tell us something about the properties of the dark matter and then the dark energy in the universe.
Crucially, Euclid will give us more data than ever before. Yeah.
So Euclid's going to look at 30 billion galaxies over about 15,000 square degrees of the sky. And if you hold your thumb at arm's length up on the sky, that's about a quarter of a square degree, right? And so four thumbprints on the sky is one square degree, and it's 15,000 square degrees of sky that we're going to look at with Euclid. So Euclid will have resolution similar to the Hubble Space Telescope, and in the first week of operations will exceed all data ever taken on the Hubble Space Telescope. And so we're expecting to truly revolutionize our view of the universe.
The hope is that this vast amount of data will lead to the most precise map of the universe that we've ever had, one that could reveal new clues about the nature of dark matter. But astronomers aren't the only ones involved. After the break, we'll hear about another approach that science is taking.
One is to try and make some dark matter, and that's really, the Large Hadron Collider is the only experiment on Earth that has a chance of doing that.
And we'll hear from Dr. Sarah Malik, who is part of a team at Imperial College London who are doing exactly that.
So once you have this imbalance in your detector, you know that some weakly interacting particle was produced and it escaped the detector without interacting.
We'll be right back.
Hi, Nicola Davis here. This episode of Science Weekly is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Before we kick off again, I wanted to recommend another one of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Audio Long Reads and contains some of The Guardian's best journalism in the form of long read articles from the paper. Recent long reads include Sebastian Malaby's piece on the collapse of The Expert and Andy Beckett's report on the resurgence of British tabloids. To subscribe to Audio Long Reads, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. And before the break, we heard how scientists are probing the nature of dark matter by mapping the cosmic web. But what might dark matter look like close up?
Sarah.
Oh.
Hi, Max.
Producer Max went to Imperial College London to find out.
Okay, yeah, so I'm Sarah Malik and I'm Royal Society University Research Fellow at Imperial College London.
Scientists have dreamt up literally thousands of possibilities for what dark matter might look like. Sarah started by explaining that a leading contender goes by the acronym WIMP, or WIMP for short.
So these are weakly interacting massive particles. They've been very popular for a number of reasons, which is that when we look at how much dark matter there is in the universe now, and we look at what some of the properties, if this were to be a class of particles, then what are some of the properties that this particle should have? It points to some attributes. And in particle physics, in trying to address some very, very different questions, and this is to do with the Higgs boson and other, some of the shortcomings of our current theoretical framework, now which is called the Stan model, it introduces a theory such as known as supersymmetry. And supersymmetry also predicts a particle that has very much the same attributes as the one that cosmology points to. So independently, cosmology and particle physics seem to point to a particle that has the same attributes. And this is what's really lent a lot of credibility to the idea that these might be WIMPs.
And is there, am I right in thinking, and I probably am not because I'm generally wrong when it comes to particle physics, but am I right in thinking that if there's supersymmetry involved, then there's a kind of, there's an analogue to the WIMP particle that we know about? Is that right?
So supersymmetry predicts that there's a super partner for every fundamental particle that we have within the Stan model. And one of the super partner for our most elusive Stan model particle, which is the neutrino, gives you the neutralino. And this is one of the most popular contenders for what dark matter might constitute.
As the name suggests, these particles interact weakly, which makes them all the more difficult to detect. But that hasn't stopped scientists at the Large Hadron Collider.
At the LHC, we're trying to produce these particles from the initial stage that we have available. So, we're colliding protons with protons at almost the speed of light. And we're hoping that one of the new particles that comes out of this, in the same way as we discovered the Higgs boson, that one of the new particles that we can produce might be the dark matter particles. So the sort of signature that these particles would leave is because they don't interact, or they interact very weakly, they would not leave any visible trace in our detectors, which means that they would essentially escape the detectors without interacting.
Which seems like a problem.
Yeah, which is a problem. But we have been there before, and this is very much analogous to one of our most elusive standard model particle, which are the neutrinos, which does the same thing. So the neutrino is produced in these collisions, and it just escapes without interacting.
But how does one go about detecting the undetectable?
So the principle that we apply to try to indirectly deduce whether these particles have been produced is momentum conservation. So the momentum before the collision is assumed in the transverse direction. So this is perpendicular to the direction in which the beams, the beam of protons are traveling. The momentum before the collision is zero, and so the momentum after the collision, if you apply momentum conservation, would also be zero. And so if you produce, let's say a set of dark matter particles together with something else that you can detect that does leave a visible trace in your detectors, then you know that the momentum in the transverse plane, when you add up the momentum of these dark matter particles and this other particle that you can detect, must add up to zero. And so what you will see is an imbalance in momentum after the collision. You'll see that in one side of the detector, you have this particle that gives you the shower of energy. And on the other hand, there's nothing to balance it because the dark matter particles or the neutrino have carried away energy in the opposite direction. And so there's an imbalance. So once you have this imbalance in your detector, you know that some weakly interacting particle was produced and it escaped the detector without interacting.
So cosmologists and LHC scientists are taking very different strategies.
Yeah. Yeah.
But is there another approach?
We think it's there.
As explained by Andrew, scientists are also trying to detect dark matter particles here on Earth, which isn't that easy when you've got no idea what you're looking for.
Oh, it's really hard. And of course, by definition, not only do you not know what it looks like, but also any kind of manifestation it has in your experiment is going to be very, very weak, because otherwise, we would feel it coming through this room if it had sort of interactions that were really noticeable. So you're looking for a very subtle signal. What we rely on is the idea that regardless of what particular particle it might be out of this zoo of possibilities, we really hope it will interact at some level through the weak nuclear force. And so that means you can build detectors that could show up at any type of these weakly interacting massive particles. It doesn't matter which particular subclass of particles, which flavour of those is the correct one. Of course, the real danger in constructing an experiment like that is there is a possibility that dark matter is a type of particle that doesn't interact even through the weak force, in which case you can build as many of those experiments as you like and you're never going to find anything. So it is really like looking for a needle in a haystack when you don't even know whether the needle's really in there or not.
And one of these detectors can be found in the Homestake mine in South Dakota.
One of the leading ones is the LUX experiment, which is stands for Liquid Underground Xenon. And what goes on in pretty much all of them is they take their detectors and they put them deep underground. Because what you want to be able to do is shield away all the sources of regular particles that might interfere with your detectors. You're looking for something so subtle that you want to shield everything else away. And having loads of rock above your head is actually really helpful for that. It just stops any kind of regular chunks of matter, things that we call cosmic rays coming from space, from reaching the detector. So the LUX experiment is one example of that, and they're using xenon, so a huge chamber of xenon, which the nucleus of the xenon atoms in that chamber is predicted to interact through the weak force in a particular way that can actually be detected.
And with all these options on the table, I asked Andrew which he would put his money on.
Oh, that's really tough. I think probably the direct detection approach is where I would put my money if you absolutely forced me to, simply because there's a kind of clear roadmap for those becoming more and more sensitive over the coming years. Whereas if you look at the Large Hadron Collider, once it gets to its maximum design energy, there's really not that much more you can do with it. You can collect more and more and more data, but if you just don't have sufficient energy in the Large Hadron Collider to create any of these dark matter particles, it's just not going to happen.
So the hope is that with more observations, better maps, and more powerful detectors, we might slowly peel back the layers and reveal the true nature of dark matter. That said, there are still those who question dark matter's very existence and suggest that instead our fundamental laws of physics may be flawed.
And it's an alternative that people do take seriously, that really at the moment all the evidence for dark matter comes from the way that it pulls other matter around through gravity. And of course, that means it's indirect. And if you can imagine changing the laws of gravity, and you don't want to do that too lightly, you know, because Einstein's laws of gravity have been incredibly successful. But if you imagine tinkering with those, you could imagine being able to get rid of the need for dark matter. The problem is, nobody's been able to come up with a way of tinkering with those laws that simultaneously maintains all the amazing successes they've had in explaining things here on Earth and in our own solar system and other things that we've measured, and also successfully accounts for what's going on with apparent dark matter. So although it's possible, nobody's been able to figure out a way of doing it, and the dark matter approach seems to fit the data really well. So that's why it's just a possibility rather than a sort of favoured possibility.
It's very plausible that all the models that we have right now don't actually come even close to describing nature. And that's one of the most fascinating things about science, is that, you know, nature has the ultimate say. We really don't know. And the more data we collect, the more constrained these models become. So every paper that we write actually constrains one or more of these models. So they become, you know, less and less favorable as we collect more data and we see nothing. And that opens up possibilities for actually going back to the drawing board and thinking of something else.
So the jury's still out on whether we'll ever directly detect dark matter. But like all our big unknowns, that shouldn't stop us from trying.
When you have a fundamental understanding of how things work...
Peter Capak again.
It allows you to then manipulate and control the world around you, right? It's our ability to understand quantum mechanics, which is a fundamentally abstract thing that most people never learn about, that allows you to build flat-screen TVs and have wireless internet and GPS, right? And so... nobody would have taken you seriously if you told them, I'm going to build a supercomputer for your pocket, and that's why I'm studying subatomic physics. But that is what comes out of these fundamental understandings of the universe. And so at trying to understand these things, it's impossible to predict what will come out. It might be that we'll just confirm that we really do understand the way the universe works, and there's these extra particles, and maybe there's a use for them, maybe there isn't. It could also be that we fundamentally change the way we're looking at the universe, and that leads to new inventions that we haven't thought of 50, 100 years down the road.
First of all, I think it's crucially important that we go after things that just don't fit. And in the end, even if you think this whole dark matter thing is on the wrong track, I think what everybody absolutely agrees on is that you cannot explain what's going on in our universe using just the known laws of physics that can be tested here on Earth. So clearly, whatever it is telling us something fundamental about how the universe operates, and so is going to push forward our understanding of nature. And in terms of, you know, the research that we do day to day, are we gambling too much on dark matter being correct? Well, maybe yes, but I think as a working hypothesis, it has been hugely successful. And that means even if in a few days' time somebody says, actually, I've worked it out, it doesn't have to be some extra weird particle, it's just that you change this one thing in an equation. Even then, it's still been worth doing all of this research into dark matter because, you know, we understand the phenomenology, we understand what's going on out there in the universe, and we should be able to take all of that knowledge and then just reinterpret it in the light of whatever amazing new theory somebody's come up with.
So is dark matter an elusive particle that we're yet to detect? Or is there a problem with our fundamental laws of gravity? Where do you stand?
And we now understand that 90% of the mass of galaxies and clusters, including our own Milky Way galaxy, is made of stuff that doesn't shine. And that isn't maybe that exciting, because there's lots of things that don't shine. You don't shine if I turn the lights out. Well, those of you from Los Alamos might, but the rest of you don't. But so it could be snowballs or planets or boring stuff, but it can't be. Because for reasons I don't have time to explain, we know how many protons and neutrons there are in the universe. We can actually measure that. And there aren't enough to make up all this dark matter.
Special thanks this week to Andrew Ponson, Peter Kapak, and Sarah Malik.
Something that doesn't normally exist on Earth. And the great thing about that is that means the dark matter isn't just out there, it's in this room. As you doze off, it's early in the morning during this lecture. It's going right through your body. And that means we can do experiments here on Earth to look for it.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.